your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Monday night, December 8th, 2025. As we record this new show, in this episode, we recap the Monday of the 2025 winter meetings. Managing editor Jim Margulis will join me later in the show to share our thoughts about what Chris Getz had to say, still valuing process and not wanting to rush things during this rebuild. But in the face of an impatient fan base, how long can the White Sox operate without a sense of urgency? Later in the show, one of our best friends, Mike Farron of MLB Network Radio, will join the show. He'll share his thoughts about the winter meetings, what he thinks of the White Sox, and a look ahead to the MLB draft lottery, which will take place on Tuesday. It was a busy day covering the Chicago White Sox at the winter meetings as both manager Will Venable and general manager Chris Getz spoke with the media. You can read that coverage on SoxMachine.com. Getz was asked about how the first day of the winter meetings went for him.
Pretty busy. It's more so, you know, we've got a big group here and getting together and having some discussions, talk to other clubs and agents. So, yeah, it's a good opportunity to get everyone together like we normally do at winter meetings and try to find ways to continue to build this club out and build momentum going into next year.
While things are moving a bit slow for everyone in Major League Baseball, Getz is not pushing more chips into the middle by trying to create action. Instead, he's happy with the process that his front office has created and the importance of staying on the current plan.
I anticipate us being even better than we were last year. Obviously, to take a significant jump like that was very positive. We expect to take another jump this upcoming year. But most importantly, and these are conversations that I have with Will and others, you know, we're not focused on win totals. We're very much focused on the process and staying on task and building opportunities and to go out there and win a ball game. And players are really starting to buy in and perform. And before you know, you're going to look up and feel a lot better about a record.
Sox Machine's James Fegan asked, if Getz is going to stick with the process, has that process created a new contending core with the players on hand?
Do you see like this core that you have in place? Like, because I know you haven't put like specific, we're trying to win the division by X year type of expectations, but you know, for fans kind of trying to buy in on like when this division is going to come about, do you see this current core you have in place as what's going to be the core of the next contending White Sox team that could, their performance can kind of drive and tell you when it's time to spend a little bit on them?
There's a lot of players on this team and close to the big leagues that's going to be part of a team that's going to contend for the division. I'm very confident in that. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves, and you know, we're just going to continue to make good decisions and help our players get even better. I mean, to take the large step forward, a lot of it's going to be the continued development of these young players. And then you've got a Braden Montgomery, Noah Schultz, Hagen Smith, Sam Antonacci, guys that are getting closer to the big leagues, and I anticipate going to be productive at the Major League club with the current players that we have, and I think that's going to show up in the win total.
One area that definitely needs to be addressed is the White Sox outfield, as Getz was asked about the current state of their outfield.
You know, we brought in Everson. We've got Braden Montgomery in the wings. You know, obviously we've got Louis Robert manning center field, and we got Benny. We got Brooks Baldwin, and we're going to continue to find ways to add. And you know, corner outfield is an area that we feel like is an area that can really boost our overall production. I think primarily it's really finding a bat that can help things. And if that's in the outfield, that's the most obvious place to look to add that. But, you know, we're not going to pigeonhole ourselves either, but just looking for ways to improve our offense overall.
Finally, this is Chris Getz's third winter meetings as general manager of the Chicago White Sox. He was asked what he's most positive about in the progress of the organization since he took over.
Well, from the beginning, infrastructure was a big commitment. And, you know, you look around different departments going down to the international side, to the internet or to the amateur, our medical process, R&D, feel really good where we're at. I do. And I think that's led to better decision making and obviously, you know, not only bringing in better players, but the development component to it. And you look at you know, a Colson Montgomery last year, and, you know, his ability to bounce back and us having the infrastructure to go out there and execute, get him back on track, and watching him, you know, perform at the major league level was rewarding for a lot of different reasons. Our acquisition of Shane Smith last year and the process that led us to make that decision, there was conviction within our group, and it worked out for us. So, you know, overall, if you look at the foundation of where things are, obviously there's usually a lag at the major league level. Thankfully, we were able to see some production out of a young group of players on our major league club. Some players that came through our system, some were trade acquisitions, some were Rule 5. So, you know, obviously we're in a position now that we feel like that's going to continue, and we're only going to be able to add and get better. And that's why we're here out in, at the winter meetings right now and looking for opportunities to continue to grow the organization.
And we are recording this segment of the podcast from the winter meetings floor at the hotel in Orlando, Florida, with one of our best friends of the show from MLB Network Radio. It is Mike Farron. Mike, thanks for coming back on the Sox Machine podcast.
Josh, it is always a pleasure to be with you. It is always a pleasure to be on the Sox Machine podcast. It's always a pleasure to talk White Sox baseball. So,
the winter meetings vibe this time around compared to last year, because like we knew Juan Soto was a free agent and we knew eventually that big news would be coming from a White Sox perspective. We knew that a Garrett Crochet trade was coming. Those were the two big headlines from last year. You talk to everyone, Mike, what's the winter meetings vibe this time?
Yeah. So like I would say the vibe around the place is like pretty good, despite the fact that nobody thinks anything's going to happen here. Right. So like, I think that's in the past, that's been like a, what are we doing? Like, how's it going? But I think everybody kind of went into this thinking because the free agent market is interesting. Right. And here's why it's interesting. There's no Juan Soto at the top, right? Kyle Tucker's the best player, right? But Tucker, you know, the second half of the season didn't go well. He had one of the worst months of his career in that. He battled two injuries in the second half, including the calf. He had the leg injury the year before. I think that gives a little bit more pause, right? You can start to see why, even though that guy is a really good player and every team should want Kyle Tucker in the lineup. Bo Bichette really doesn't have a defensive position, right? He had a bad year 2 years ago. He finished the year with a knee injury, right? So, like, there's a couple things that are playing out there, and these are guys that are going to get, you know, in Bichette's case, well over $200 million, and probably in Tucker's case, I think it'll end up being south of $400 million, but it'll be like similar to the Trey Turner contract. So I think there's a little bit of pause because there's a little less certainty there. I think you have some teams that are sitting out the high end of the market, like the Dodgers, who tend to drive other teams to do big things. You know, Toronto could jump in on that, and I think that they will do something big. I think there are teams that are going to spend that are big market ones, but they don't not necessarily, these guys aren't necessarily fits, or at least fits right away until they see what some of the other moves are. And so I think that kind of slows down the market too. So I think those are all things that are causing it to be a little bit slower. There's not that stud starting pitcher. There's some really good ones, but that will try and drive it a little bit later, and especially with the position players. And then I do think that there is a significant amount of trade talk that's going on. And the way the offseason generally works, at least the way it's been explained to me by the former GMs that I work with, is that the first part of the offseason is like you get hot and heavy making trades because you've checked in on free agents and you're not sure. And then the trade, you're like, it's a little too rich. So you go back to the free agents and you sign some free agents. And then the free agents are really rich. So you go back to the trade market because you feel like it's going to be cheaper. And then once you've exhausted that, then you get all the free agents. So we're kind of in that transition phase because we just saw the run on relievers, the annual reliever palooza, right? And there's still some good ones left where we're kind of getting into that trade market. And the free agency probably gets pushed a little later as a result.
Yeah, Dylan Cease right now is the biggest free agent deal with Toronto for 7 years, $210 million. So if you had to guess before everybody leaves for the winter meetings, what do you think is the biggest move that's made?
I think there's three that I think are possibilities. I think Mackenzie Gore getting traded by the Nationals.
Which is wild to me.
I don't think so, because the team needs a lot of talent. They are not close to competing. He's 2 years away from free agency. So
yeah,
I know
I guess,
it feels
yeah.
like this is it probably gives you PTSD as somebody who does a podcast about a team that is in the midst of a rebuild or never really saw the previous one pay off. But they have a new front office, and you know, I was talking to somebody with the Nationals today about this, and I agree with them. you can't hold this front office responsible for what the previous ones did. Like, if you're truly evaluating it, if you're a fan, you absolutely can. Because if I were a fan, I would be ticked off about the fact that really the Nationals have been irrelevant since they won the World Series in 2019, mm-hmm. at least in terms of competition for a playoff spot, despite the fact that they made one of the biggest home run trades of all time, right? And they didn't do enough to support it around them. So there's a lot of infrastructure things that were going wrong with the Nationals, similar to what the White Sox went with, right? So, like, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that needs to happen, and they're not going to be a playoff team in 2 years when Gore's a free agent, before he's a free agent, and probably not in three when C.J. Abrams is. So that's why I think it makes sense that Gore would move. I think Brendan Donovan is another name. Again, similar. Cardinals' timetable isn't all that great. Theirs is a little different in that they have J.J. Weatherholt pretty close to ready to take over at second base. So Donovan, I think, is a really intriguing trade chip, and I wouldn't be surprised if he gets done here. And then only because we heard the report that the Pirates have made an offer to Kyle Schwarber, it's set a floor for the market. So now it's going to be – what's going to happen is that the Pirates are going to make that offer. Cincinnati's going to make one. Maybe the Pirates raise theirs a little. Maybe Cincinnati makes theirs. And then it's going to be the decision on whether or not the Phillies want to get in and top that. I think that's got a chance to happen in the relatively near future, just because we know where the floor is now of 4 years and just over $100 million, which I don't think is going to be close to getting it done, but at least there's a floor there. So that would be my guess, which means that none of those three things are going to happen before we leave Orlando.
No Skubal.
No, Skubal's not getting traded.
I'd be floored too.
I mean, here's the thing is that, like, so the best comp to use for Tarik Skubal in trade is when Corbin Burns got traded to Baltimore. So the return for Burns, and granted it might be a little bit better, but not much for Detroit, was the return was Joey Ortiz, who's a glove first shortstop and a really good defender who has not hit. He's been a different hitter at the big league level than he was in the minors. D.L. Hall, a left-handed pitcher who had big upside but a ton of injuries, who has not been able to stay healthy. And a first-round draft pick, the 34th overall pick. It was one of the comp-round picks that can be traded, which turned into Brock Burke, who I think might end up being a decent first baseman for Milwaukee down the line. He was a big star at Tennessee. Controls the strike zone pretty well, but didn't have huge power numbers this year. But, like, that was it. Like, that doesn't – that does that scream to you, like, if you were trading Tarik Skubal, would that be an acceptable return for you?
No.
So, like, I don't think Tarik Skubal's getting dealt.
Yeah, I agree on that. It's sad for the Nationals' perspective, because Mackenzie Gore and C.J. Abrams, at least in my opinion, are guys that you could build around. But if they are 3 to 5 years away from competing, I understand. But, yeah, a sore spot for someone who covers the Chicago White Sox.
Yeah, I mean, I think, listen, I think their guys to build around are James Wood and Dylan Cruz.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that there are going to be some other secondary pitching pieces that they develop. Like, there's what the Nationals look like in 2 years is going to be completely different than what the Nationals look like under Mike Rizzo. And that's not a knock on Riz. They won a World Series there. They're consistently competitive. It's just that this is a completely different mindset. It is a more modern mindset that they're going through.
So turning back to the White Sox, how are you feeling about the White Sox in early December?
How am I feeling about them for 2026? I don't think they'll be very good. How am I thinking about the direction of the organization? Extremely positive. I am really pleasantly surprised. In fact, I said it to Chris Getz today, and I think we've talked about this. Like, I was super critical of that move. I know we text about it.
Yeah.
Like, it just felt like nothing's going to change. And I've spent 2 years doing mea culpa on it, and I wanted to do it to Chris's face because he has absolutely modernized that organization. I think he's hired a lot of really, really good people. I think they are attacking this with the right way, throwing as much talent as they can. And listen, I think a couple of the first trades were probably missteps in terms of what they got in return. You know, I think the C-Steel probably isn't going to pay any great dividends. And certainly the deals with the Dodgers, that Dodgers-Cardinals three-team deal. Vargas had a nice year in the end. Like, it wasn't bad. You know, that one may not look great with some of the other prospects they got. But I think the trade with Boston was a really good one. I think there's four big leaguers in that, right? Like, that's going to be pretty good. And I think that their draft strategy is right on. I think they're going to increase their international development. I think hiring Dave Keller to do that was a smart move, and I think he's going to make an impact. I just think that from the stuff that White Sox fans can't see if they're just watching the game on a given night, and I don't like begrudge you just not giving a damn about all that stuff. Just know that they're in a really good position. I feel like right now, and I think they're going to be trending in the they are trending in the right direction. It's just going to be a couple more years for their competitive team.
Do you buy what we saw from Colson Montgomery post All-Star break? Was that real?
I think the power is real. I think, like, if I were to guess, he's going to be a low average, high power hitter who plays on the left side of the diamond. I think the thing that was most encouraging to me was that the metrics were really pretty good at shortstop. Like, yes. That was the one that I wasn't necessarily expecting. And the way it works is, like, when you play a middle of the field position like shortstop, catcher, or center field, if you can play that position defensively, then the bar for what you need to do offensively to contribute is significantly lower. So if you're a low average hitter who draws about an average amount of walks, and his was a little bit above the league average, and strikes out a bunch so that you're hitting in like the 220s, but you hit 30 home runs, like that's a pretty valuable player, 25 homers if you can play a good shortstop. So I think the power is real. I don't think he's going to hit 45 homers or whatever he was on pace to in the second half, but I do think he's capable of hitting 25-plus over the course of a full major league season, and I think he's got a chance to be a pretty solid shortstop. Now, that said, let me just put this in there. I would not be surprised if he has a lot of struggles early next year because the league is really adjusted, and they're going to find the holes that were the most significant ones, and the question is, how does he close them up, or has he done work to try and close holes before he gets there, and has he opened up other holes? And that's something that's like, that was what happened to Corbin Carroll a couple of years ago. So I'm gonna say that, like, I think long term I'm still really on Montgomery. I would view him with a little bit of caution just based on the track record of most prospects going into the season, but I think he's got a chance to be an everyday player on the left side of the infield and one that hits for power. And, you know, listen, like, one of the things that I think deserves a lot of credit for the White Sox is we knew this like 2 years ago. They were terrible at getting on base, right?
Yes.
So running out the top six guys had above average walk rates in their lineup, right? And, like, that's – Montgomery is part of that group. So there's some big organizational changes that are going on. And Montgomery, I know, had to work through a ton of stuff, you know, working with Matt Fuller, going back to the complex, all of that this year. I think it's going to pay off for them in the aggregate in the long run, even if Montgomery probably is not going to be like a 300 hitter, like that kind of player, but low average power hitting shortstop who can catch the ball, I think that's a pretty valuable guy.
So we're talking about shortstops, and we're recording this prior to the MLB draft lottery, which, again, the Chicago White Sox have the best odds of getting the number one overall pick. But as I wrote to podcast listeners on SoxMachine.com, for the first 3 years of the MLB draft lottery, the team with the best odds of getting the number one pick hasn't gotten the number one pick.
Well, what does that mean for tomorrow?
It means if the pattern continues, the White Sox won't have the number one pick. This team with the second pick overall, or the second best odds, hasn't drafted in the top five yet, Mike. They haven't even drafted in the top six. Yeah. So if I'm the Minnesota Twins, I'm a little bit more worried than the Chicago White Sox if this draft lottery chaos continues. But when it comes to MLB draft, and I've written about it on SoxMachine.com, and everyone's talking about it, this seems to be that everyone's hoping they get the number one pick for UCLA shortstop Rock Chalowski. I picked him to be my Dick Howser Award winner. He didn't end up winning the award. He was a finalist. Now he's entering his junior year. For our podcast listeners, Mike, what do they need to know about Rock?
Yeah, well, I think Chalowski is a really good all-around player. He's from Phoenix. So he went to high school not far from where I live. He's the son of a longtime scout. He has a really good baseball mind. I mean, his instincts are exceptional. He's a right, you know, hitter. So right-handed thrower, obviously, is a shortstop, but a right-handed hitter. He's got some power, some speed. I think it probably plays more like gap-to-gap power in the big leagues than it is going to be like a 25-plus homer bat. But just a really complete player. And he's been that since high school, right? Like, he's one of those guys that, as much as we talk about progression not being linear, it's been a pretty linear progression from him going from, like, because I think his floor is really high because he just knows how to play the game. He's always in the right spot. He makes good decisions. He has great instincts. He's not that dissimilar from, like, Dylan Cruz when he was drafted in that regard. Like, I think he's a special guy whose intangibles are really strong. The tangible is good, above average runner, above average defender, above average hitter with probably average to maybe a tick above power. That's a pretty valuable guy and one who can play shortstop every day in the big leagues, and I think that's what he is. But I think he's probably cut more from the overall value mold of, like, a Dansby Swanson as a shortstop than he is of like a peak Carlos Correa.
Yeah, and this is another talented draft class when it comes to high school shortstops. And I'm going to make fun of myself because we've been texting back and forth. And podcast listeners, I'm a coward. There's a part of me wants to rank Texas prep shortstop Grady Emerson ahead of Rock Chalowski, which would be going against the grain. But let me explain why I think this is a 1A, 1B situation. And Mike, let me know if I'm wrong. But even like talking to Mike Shirley or even Gene Watson, the director of player development for player personnel for the Chicago White Sox, it seems like the White Sox are having an effort here, and this is why they're spending so much money and adding scouts on the international side. It is about age, and it's about trying to get as young of prospects as possible. I had Travis Sawchuk on the podcast talking about bat speed and age, and it seems like when you're between ages 22 and 25, that's the best years you're going to have when it comes to bat speed because it makes sense. That's really your physical prime. And you want as many players as possible to get in that age range. Well, the only way that happens is if you get 16 and 17-year-olds from the Dominican Republic or you draft high schoolers because, not against Rock, but he's going to be 21 when he gets drafted, spends a year at Double-A with the White Sox. At age 23, then we can talk about him possibly joining the Major League team. Whereas if you draft like Grady Emerson, first overall, when he's 21, he's going to be either in Double-A or with Charlotte, whereas Rock was at UCLA.
Yeah.
So that's why I almost want to feel like putting Grady Emerson first overall and go against the grain. But, I'm a coward. I'm not doing that quite yet, podcast listeners. But for our podcast listeners who are just hearing the name Grady Emerson for the first time, what should they know about Grady?
Well, let me go back to what you talked about, though, with all of those. And I think all of those things are right. And I think it's especially true for position players that we have a lot of data that shows that young players, like young for their high school class in particular, have more success against than other phylums of player. And I think part of that is because they're younger playing against older competition, right? Like, that makes sense, right? That fits in, like, every Malcolm Gladwell book that you've read, right? So I think that tracks. Okay, so we understand that. But I think some of that reliance on just the bat speed data doesn't show is the improvements that players can make in pitch selection and not like in determining balls and strikes, but which pitch they can drive. And if there is a trade-off between peak bat speed and controlling the strike zone and using what bat speed you have. So yeah, I think you know, like, obviously you want those physical skills to be able to match up with the difficulty of pitching, but I think that there are plenty of ways to mitigate that. The other part I would say is that, like, we've seen guys move through the minor leagues so freaking fast at this point that, like, that timetable that you laid out may be too slow for a guy like Chalowski. Like, he's going to rise through the minor leagues very quickly, and I wouldn't be surprised if he goes number one overall in June and then is ready to play in the big leagues at some point in 2027. So that's something that I would say. Now, all of that said, I haven't been asked to do rankings, but Grady Emerson would be number one on my board because I think that there is more impact potential there. He is a no-doubt shortstop. I think he has more power than Chalowski. I think he's as good a hitter. I think he has a stronger arm. I think he's a really good defender. He may not be the runner that Chalowski is, but I think he has the look of a guy that could be a first-division shortstop. There are elements, and if you remember the first part of this guy's career, it's probably going to mean more to you than if you remember the second point where you're going to be like, well, why would you compare him to that? That guy's not that great. But the first time I saw Grady Emerson walk into the batter's box, I went, oh, my God, it's Stephen Drew.
Okay.
And when Stephen Drew was coming up, Stephen Drew was, a legit power speed prospect. And if you remember back to his early days with the Diamondbacks, before he had the leg injuries, he was a 2020 guy with great defense and had a couple 5-WAR seasons, if I remember right. So he was a really good player. I think Emerson has the most upside. I think he's got a chance to be an absolute all-star at shortstop. I don't know if a multiple time or go to, you know, one or two, but I think he's got a chance to be really good. And this is a good collection of players at short and the top of the draft. Those are the top two guys right now. The next group is pretty good. It probably falls off a little bit after like 8, 9, 10, that range right now. But this is going to be a much better college class than last year. This is going to be a much deeper draft than last year's was. So I'm in on Grady Emerson. I think he is as good a player as there is. And listen, the guys behind, like Jacob Lombard, who's George Lombard, the Tigers bench coach's other son. You know, he's got one son that's in the Yankees organization. A little bit of swing and miss, but some pretty loud tools, louder tools than his brother has. Justin LeBron, who, if we had done this a year ago, would have been like, oh, yeah, he's number one on the 2026 board. He's the shortstop at Alabama. Like, those are guys that you're going to hear in this mix, too. Drew Burris, the center fielder at Georgia Tech, who's this little sawed-off 5'8", like, guy who, the first week in college baseball as a freshman, hit four homers in a game. And, like, he controls the strike zone really well. And he played on travel teams with guys like Rock Chalowski and the third baseman at UCLA, who should be a first rounder too, and Roman Martin, and like that really loaded prep class in 23 he was a part of. So it's a good draft overall, but right now I would have Emerson ahead of Chalowski.
One of the guys to keep an eye on, White Sox fans, because knock on wood, the White Sox do get one of the top two picks, and then it's the best of the worlds. If somebody takes Rock Chalowski one first overall, the White Sox could take Grady Emerson. I also like LSU outfielder Derek Curiel.
Yeah, he can really hit.
Podcast listeners, his like whiff rate in the zone was 5%.
Mm-hmm.
A 5% whiff rate against SEC pitching on pitches in the strike zone. Like, his contact rate, and just watching him last year, Mike, super impressed. If he comes out with another year under his belt in development in LSU's program and hits 20 homers – like, White Sox fans are wondering, where are the outfielders in draft classes? Like, that is a guy to keep an eye on because he's a draft-eligible sophomore. Let's see if he hits for more power. But I'm with you. It's Emerson and Chalowski as 1A, 1B.
And Curiel is really good and was as a prep. And there's at least a
puncher's chance.
Yeah, Orange Lutheran in Southern California, like, great, great high school program. He has a chance to stay in center field. He's got a puncher's chance of being there, which would add significant value to him. I think it's a great name to mention as a guy who could bust out. And listen, like, just because we've got Chalowski and Emerson 1-2 right now doesn't mean that's going to be the case
exactly
in June.
Yeah.
You know, like, there are going to be there, but what I would say is that there's enough talent in that first half of, you know, if you start to look, I think Pipeline put out their list, you look in the top 20, 30 names, like, I think there is enough talent in that group that regardless of where you pick in that if the, you know, the White Sox, let's say they win the lottery to some degree and they're in the top six picks, they're going to end up with good stuff. But don't use the past predictor of what's going to happen there, because all of that's irrelevant. It's like saying my neighbor won the lottery yesterday, so I can't win it today. That means nothing.
Well,
you can't win the lottery because nobody wins the lottery.
Hopefully luck is on the White Sox side when it comes to MLB draft lottery, even though recent history sorry, Mike, hasn't been good to the teams with the best odds. But no team has had the better odds than the White Sox at 27% to get the number one overall pick. And again, we'll have the live coverage of the MLB draft lottery. Jim Margulis will be covering that for us on SoxMachine.com. But you can follow Mike on social media. He's at Mike_Farren on Twitter. He's at Mike Farren on Blue Sky, and of course listen to him on Sirius XM Radio, on MLB Network Radio, and of course we'll be chatting with Mike again when college baseball season kicks off in Valentine's Day in February.
Oh, man.
Big tournament. Speaking of Rock Chalowski, he's going to be facing SEC schools in that tournament in Arlington, Texas in late February, so a lot to look forward to. Should be a great college baseball season.
Oh, I can't wait. But it's going to be so good.
It is going to be
really
good. The
early season tournaments this year are really good.
They're really good. So, but as always, Mike, thank you so much for hopping on the Sox Machine podcast.
Anytime.
To end this podcast, we are back at the Sox Machine house in Orlando, Florida for our winter meeting stay. And joining me is the managing editor of the Sox Machine podcast. It is Jim Margulis, as we have James Fegan scouting the bar, trying to text agents to get the latest news, rumors, gossipers of what's going on with the Chicago White Sox. Will chime in on that topic in a moment. But Jim, a really busy day for us at Sox Machine as far as covering the Chicago White Sox. Will Venable had his winter meetings press conference, followed by the media scrum with Chris Getz. After getting a chance to chat with both Will Venable and Chris Getz, what's your big takeaway from today?
There was no big takeaway, I think, in terms of like news, this, something to lead a headline, something to lead a story. And I think in a very meta sense, that is the story of just after 3-100 loss seasons, still not anything for White Sox fans to sink their teeth into. And I think you really get a sense of it. Like Chris Getz seems calm, reasonable, rational about it. He seems at ease with the work that they're doing to improve the infrastructure and processes that they use to develop talent, decision-making, et cetera. But 4 years of this, and you know, that's as long as we've been going to the winter meetings, you know, Nashville, Dallas, you know, here, like not an exciting, you know, there was a Garrett Crochet trade, but that's not like baseball excitement. That's just big news. And, you know, it's just White Sox fans, I think, want something to say like, hey, is this going to happen? Are there going to be resources put into this? And I think you really get a sense of it, you know, because Getz is at ease. But I think you get a sense, more of a sense of it when Venable talks, just because he has to run out the product on the field and he has to answer questions about the lineup construction and depth charts and rotation options. And, you know, the wins and losses go on his record. They don't really keep GM wins and losses. So when we're trying to like look at, you know, the way Venable is trying to sell it, I think it's harder for him to sell because he's, you know, in one sense supposed to have answers for somebody putting the product in the field. And the fact that he's, you know, still kind of warmed over answers, I think that's what makes it difficult for him. So like, yeah, I think Getz, he makes sense to a certain degree, but you know, if it's a case of like his hands are just tied by how little Jerry Reinsdorf wants to spend, and they're kind of just counting down the, well, maybe months until the CBA, or count down the years until there's a new owner, it's just, that's just a long time to expect your fans just to be in a circling pattern, basically.
Yeah, Chris Getz speaks like a general manager that has no fear of losing his job, even though his teams have lost 222 games the last two seasons.
Yes.
Which is remarkable in professional sports to lose that much and not even having to sweat about your job. He's very proud, and you heard that at the beginning part of this podcast, listeners. He's very proud of the infrastructure that they have started for the Chicago White Sox. We haven't heard about the Dominican Republic facility, the new one. I know they're building it, but I don't think it's completed yet. If it was completed, maybe James would have got an invite to go down to the Dominican Republic to go check it out for us. We know that they've done a lot as far as the minor league system, and that clearly has helped on the player development side. But I'm with you, Jim. Like, when you hear Chris Getz speak about where the White Sox are, it seems like, according to Getz's plan, they're on schedule. They're on the right track. The process matters more right now for the White Sox than the results, even though Chris Getz does admit that this is a results-oriented business. But like with Will Venable, when even asked about like the outfield, you can just tell, even though Venable is the most optimistic guy, maybe the most positive manager in Major League Baseball, but it's pretty clear, Jim, Will Venable is not happy with his current outfield configuration. It is very hopeful that things change between now and, let's say, even Sox Fest, which is at the end of January, where Will Venable has a better outfield on hand. But it's a matter of like the talent on hand, and it's a lot of leaning on the young guys to continue to carry on this progress. But there's no certainty, to your point, that in free agency or in the trade market right now, when Chris Getz speaks, that the White Sox either have a big appetite to add impact free agents to be here for multiple years, to be part of this new contending core, because that's a question that James asked, like, do you feel like you got a contending core on your hands? And it sounds like Chris Getz does. Okay, well, if that's the case, and if other teams right now are sputtering in the offseason, does your boss, Jerry Reinsdorf, see that opportunity to add an impact free agent who will be here for the next 5 to 6 years and help carry this team through the rest of this rebuild into contention. And it just doesn't seem like, no, that's not in the cards for the White Sox.
Yeah, I mean, Venable, you know, I wouldn't say that he's, you know, maybe he's probably not thrilled about the outfield depth chart, but he did later in the session say that, like, he's, you know, has a great relationship with Getz. They work well together. You know, he's, you know, Getz does a lot to support him, which I don't doubt just because we did see what Getz looks like when he doesn't support a manager. And that was Pedro Grifol's second year of just kind of indifference, winning the day in 121 losses being the result. So I do think that, you know, Getz makes an effort to support him, but I think it's just, it's almost like he's bootstrapping it himself and like, I got to lay the pieces in place because I can't afford to go into debt if I make a wrong decision. And, but it's 4 years of waiting. It's so just so drawn out. And thing is, like, you know, you have service time clocks running, you have arbitration eligibility, you know, it's still a couple of years away in some cases, but you're seeing like the guys who are not supposed to go back down the minors. So you have an idea of like, they're going to be around for the next 6 years and they're going to be cheap for the next 3 years. And you can't expect any help from the international side coming anytime soon. So you cross that off. You have a farm system that's now, you know, they have a couple collegiate pitchers. They have, advanced pitchers, high minors pitchers. You have Braden Montgomery. But the rest of it is more guys in A-ball, guys who have not yet reached A-ball, high school picks. So they're going to be coming, or the bulk of that's going to be coming in a couple of years. It just all feels very disjointed and like pieces are approaching major league standard caliber at different times.
Yeah.
And, you know, money would equalize that a little bit. Money would be a way to, you know, prop up one area that's coming up short or help extend a window for an area that needs time to come along. And that's not there either. So they're operating without an international program providing anything, and they're operating without money. So it's, they have to get everything else right. And I imagine that's why Getz is trying to be very careful and deliberate. But it's just, yeah, you can see a window, and I think Baseball America talked about this in their podcast when evaluating the rebuild. It's like, is this team better than 85 wins if everybody on hand arrives at the same time and is like their 50th, 60th percentile outcome? Like not blowing away projections, but not underperforming, just reasonable outcomes from their development paths. And like, that's pretty depressing if you lose 100 games, you know, 3 years in a row, maybe 4 years in a row. We'll see what, you know, this year brings. Mm-hmm. And 85 wins is the peak that comes after based on the talent that's already on hand. Like that should be setting off alarms somewhere that either, you know, money needs to show up or somebody who's a lot more transactional and just trading anything that isn't nailed down just to try to, you know, turn over the roster and find pieces that fit better. But yeah, just very careful and very sluggishly paced.
A long time ago, when I started the world in the corporate world, I had a, let's call him a disgruntled employee, but a wise veteran said, you can never underperform expectations if you never have expectations.
Yeah.
And that kind of feels the way with the White Sox, like Chris Getz avoiding saying that, yeah, this is the year. We're going to take another step forward. Our goal is to be 71-91, 10 wins better than last this previous season. He won't state that. It's a focus on the process, continuing the process, and the results will come. And it's not as arrogant as saying, ask me after the parade. But again, Chris Getz does speak like he is a GM that has a lifetime contract, and that's certainly not the case, of course. And
he'll get 20 years.
Well, we'll see. I mean, if Jerry Reinsdorf's still the owner, probably. Oh,
yeah. But I mean, like, yeah, Rick Hahn, basically, he was around for 20 years.
Yeah.
So
it's just at some point there needs to be a sense of urgency. Maybe we're a year too early to pound the table and say the White Sox must have a sense of urgency. But I think that time comes next year if there isn't a lockout, or if there is a lockout, but they're still going to be able to play all 162 games of the season, because your core, all the players that he listed, all those young players, is not going to get any cheaper. That's the cheapest it'll ever be for you. So that would be the most meaningful time to add high salary players to your payroll, because you're still at a reasonable amount of payroll. Hopefully you get a boost in attendance and in stadium revenue and TV money with more subscribers to CHSN. So it covers that cost, or gives you, not only covers that cost, but gives you extra cash going to 2028 that you can continue adding to this momentum of adding players to your roster in free agency and in trades. But if you purposely punt 2026 because of the process, and after the 2026 season, the process is still not ready, and you're in 2027, well, now your core is going to start getting more expensive because they're heading into arbitration. Like, you do need to have, the White Sox do need to have like a 3-year plan, and maybe Chris Getz is holding those cards pretty close to the chest. But the 1-year plan really sounds like we're going to try to find, it's a repeat of last year's free agency. We're going to try to find guys on 1 to 2 year contracts like Anthony Kay. Nothing too crazy on the salary front. They're going to complement the players that we currently have on hand. But if the White Sox do make another move, Chris Getz keeps bringing up he would like to add a bat. And he did admit, logically, it makes sense if it's in the outfield. But regardless of what position it is, they want to add another bat to the lineup. So I guess that might be a hint of the next move that Getz really wants to make, Jim, is that he does want to make additions, but it's not going to be on the levels of like Kyle Schwarber. But that's Kyle, a player like Kyle Schwarber is the level of talent that this White Sox team needs to add to the roster to get fans to believe that brighter days are coming.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe my one reservation, like talking a guy like Schwarber, is like it brings to mind like the Jeff Samardzija or sure. like Adam LaRoche off season, just like, which I didn't mind in isolation when they had that off season of just, you know, Zach Duke and Melky Cabrera and everybody coming aboard and being older and like less upside, but like, sure, like inject some talent and support this core, see what it does. But then like, they didn't spend past it. Like, you know, that was, I thought when they built up like that, I thought, okay, if this doesn't work, they'll keep spending because that's the whole idea. And they didn't. Like Adam LaRoche had, I think, what, $12, $13 million on his second year after a miserable first year. And they just were committed to him until he retired. And then because they're committed to him and didn't have a backup plan, they did not have anybody to take advantage of that sudden windfall of cash, and they had to wait for Justin Morneau to get healthy, and that didn't work out. So, like, I get why, you know, Getz has been on hand or at least aware of other mistakes Han made or other things he tried to line up and then couldn't do, whether it was, like, trying to spend on Manny Machado, and maybe he did have the purest of intentions to see that through and Reinsdorf pulled the football on him. Or, you know, maybe he really thought that he was going to hire A.J. Hinch and get like the kind of leadership and modernization of the dugout, and Tony La Russa happened instead. And so Getz is really trying to hire all of his people and trying to put everything in place and not overcommit to anybody who could possibly handcuff him later. It is, you know, there is a logic to it. There is a not going down the same path and digging the same hole Han did, but it does speak to the White Sox lack of standards that, you know, Getz and Getz's predecessor both ended up in the same place of just, you know, and Han did the same thing in a different way, talking about like, well, I can't, you know, I don't want to spend this money on much on, this much money on Manny Machado, because what happens 5 years from now when Eloy Jimenez is a free agent or Luis, and like, how do you know you're going to be around 5 years from now? Like, why are you talking like that? This is your time. But because he was so worried about like having to clean up his own messes, because he assumed he would be the one to clean up his mess, they just it just became such a conservative approach up and down. And I think Getz, you know, maybe he's adjusting for that a little bit with trying to get all of his lieutenants in place up and down to where like everybody's on the same page. He's not fighting against Jerry and against Kenny on certain decisions and against everybody else, or being outnumbered or outcounted in the decision-making. So that makes some sense, but it is, you know, the results-oriented business and also an interest-related business, an entertainment business of giving fans a reason to show up or watch on TV and want to go back once they go to a ballpark. And when you lose 100 games 3 years in a row and are not motivated by that in the offseason, just, you know, fans can't wait around forever.
And that's a good point, Jim. A lot of that sales pitch and marketing for the White Sox is going to be come see the kids. Like, these kids can play is going to be the campaign. Like, come watch Colson Montgomery and see Kyle Teal and eventually Hagen Smith, the Noah Schultz and Brayden Montgomery. And maybe that works again in 2026. And like I mentioned, we might be a year early with this trying to be the canary in the coal mine for the Chicago White Sox. But this moment is coming soon. And it doesn't sound like Chris Getz is pressed right now to having to create a sense of urgency and set expectations like, okay, now it's time to win. It's like the White Sox are still not there. So I think it is fair from a entertainment perspective for White Sox to be like, okay, then why am I going to the ballpark?
Yeah, everything's downstream of him. You know, Will Venable talking is downstream of Getz. John Triffin trying to sell interest in a broadcast is downstream of Getz. Brooks Boyer trying to come up with marketing ploys, giveaways, et cetera, to get people into the ballpark in spite of the product is downstream of Getz. And Getz is downstream of Reinsdorf. So it's not, it's, you know, I realize the challenges to a certain extent that Getz faces, but, you know, there's just the lack of salesmanship or customer awareness, I think, is. Yeah, you know, and you've talked about this with the president of baseball operations,
yes,
or somebody with a different, somebody with a background of selling, or either selling a vision or articulating fan awareness while also balancing the baseball interests. Getz, I think, you know, he's a baseball guy through and through. I understand why he's doing what he's doing in the order he's doing it, but it does make everybody's jobs harder.
We'll see what the White Sox do again from today with Venable and Chris Getz. I do think that the outfield needs to be addressed. I think that's pretty clear from a White Sox perspective. Miguel Vargas is still going to get time at first and at third base. Will Venable does not have any certainty when it comes to the World Baseball Classic. He knows a couple of players on the team right now are having talks with their respective countries about playing for them, but nothing certain.
It feels like Lenin Sosa is one of them.
Yeah, Lenin. It does feel like Lenin's one of them. Curtis Meade could be another for Team Australia, but from a Will Venable point of view, it's like neither of you have options remaining, and I need some answers from both of you that you are better on defense, Lenin, and Curtis, you're a better hitter. So if you're going to be missing spring training, boy, that makes a decision tough for me as your manager if you come back and you're not hitting.
Well, I think Meade is probably, I think Sosa has shown enough, at least as a hitter.
Sure.
At the major league level to earn a benefit of the doubt. And I think, you know, we've seen a World Baseball Classic. I don't think there's definitive proof on any kind of effect, hangover effect, or lack of preparation. I think it's a mixed bag from what I recall 3 years ago. Of players playing better, some playing worse, and just it sounds like a regular sample size of players overperforming and underperforming and all kind of within one standard deviation of what they're supposed to do. So, yeah, for Sosa, who showed what he showed last year and playing competitive baseball, high-stakes baseball, maybe not the worst thing for him because, you know, he has to make decisions. He has to, it does simulate important game speed for him. I think Meade, you know, certainly being an Australian major leaguer, you understand why he'd want to be out there if he's one of those players, and can understand, like, baseball wouldn't mind having a Curtis Meade on Team Australia just to make that team more competitive. But yeah, it does come at a delicate juncture of his career of being like, well, this might be your opportunity at the White Sox. And then if this doesn't work out, then you're kind of off a roster and have to battle your way back up, and then you might be on minor league contracts. It does get trickier if Meade doesn't ace it. But I could see Venable saying, like, yeah, you know, Chris Getz or whoever saying, like, it's important baseball. Hopefully you come back really dialed in. And they might.
They might.
Yeah.
I think the last thing with Chris Getz, and this is just my warning, is just don't be like your predecessor and think that you have this job forever. You don't. So just be careful of constantly being okay. And I think if you asked him straight up, he would say, I'm not okay with the losses. As a former player, this does bug me, but I am positive about our long-term future of the Chicago White Sox. We're going in the right direction. It's not what White Sox fans want to hear right now, as White Sox fans have every reason to be impatient with the organization. I just don't know where to direct you right now with your pitchforks and torches. Probably the same answer, Jerry Reinsdorf. And maybe things change when Justin Ishbia takes over, and if Ishbia wants to make a big splash right away, and then maybe we'll find out if Chris Getz can actually spend money or not, because we learned from Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams in that second wave of their tenure, they were not very good at spending money. So,
unless, you know, and this is the case where Ishbia, if he's on deck, like, you know, maybe it's a different GM because he wants somebody who knows how to spend money.
And all that work that Chris Getz did right now in the past few years is for what for him? What does he take away?
I mean, it could be a case of just
pat on the back. Thanks, Chris, building us a Dominican facility.
Yeah, it could be a case of like he goes to be an assistant GM somewhere else and bounces back just fine. Like there is value in what he's doing. There's like a lot of teams. You know, I guess the tricky thing is with Getz, like if you're getting an organization that was woefully behind the times into some facsimile of up to speed, then, you know, perhaps the rest of the league isn't that impressed because, like, oh, congratulations, you are where we were 3 years ago.
Sure.
So it is a little bit tricky, but I think, I'm sure the lack of money and, you know, Reinsdorf not being interested in spending money to make money, somebody not willing to run a bad balance sheet for a year or two just to generate interest, like, that's not his game. Like, I imagine that's the driving force of just not wanting to have any missteps. But like, if you don't take any steps like that, it's like errors. You know, if you don't get to a ball, it can't be charged with an error. In this case, like if I don't take any steps forward, I don't try to move forward, I won't have taken any missteps. And it's supposed to be entertainment is what I keep coming back to. And it's not entertaining.
They started, 5-25 last year? I remember them only having, like, 5 wins after April.
Yeah, something like that.
You do that again with this young of a team, I don't know what that says for the rest of the season when it comes to attendance. It's a lot of pressure on these young guys to perform and perform like they did in the second half of this year. And we're all hopeful that that's the case, but that really seems like the White Sox game plan coming into this offseason is the young kids will carry us. We'll find some veterans on 1 to 2 year deals. We'll add them to the team so we're not too embarrassing in the outfield. We have another starting pitcher that could help out with depth.
They were 7-23 at the end of April.
7-23. Yep. Hopefully they don't do that again. Because if they do that, I would love to hear from you podcast listeners on what your confidence would be in the Chicago White Sox if being carried heavily by this young squad, if they stumble out of the gates like that, on how you would feel for the rest of the season. As we sign off on this podcast episode, this recaps is pretty much the Monday for the winter meetings. There is a, let's call it a loose rumor of reliever Peter Fairbanks and the Chicago White Sox. Scott Merkit of MLB.com wrote that the White Sox have had, quote, preliminary interest in Fairbanks. And I know Merk asked a question during the scrums with Venable and Getz that they wanted to add a more established reliever to the team, and that definitely is Fairbanks. But even like Venable, and I've been pondering this all throughout his first year as manager, and this just came to my head, and I really wish I thought of this because I wanted to ask him like what his philosophy is with closers. But in a way, he did answer that question today. It'd be great if you have a dependable closer, but Venable's only comfortable in having that kind of guy if you have answers for the sixth, seventh, and eighth innings. And right now for Venable, the White Sox don't have dedicated guys in the sixth, seventh, and eighth innings. So why would you give me a closer? I still need help getting to the ninth inning with their bullpen. It seems like with Fairbanks, I can understand the White Sox calling Fairbanks' agent and asking like how much it would cost to sign him. And I guess I would consider that preliminary interest in a player, Jim. But this seems to be a weird target for the White Sox in free agency if this is an area that they do want to spend, especially after we just said and how bad the outfield is right now.
Yeah, it's the value, and we've seen this before with the White Sox, like in trying to acquire somebody they might be able to trade at the deadline. I think that's one of the driving factors if they are trying to find like a 1 or 2 year deal for Fairbanks. He had an $11 million option that was declined by the Rays. So that's why he's a free agent. You know, his peripherals are sliding a little bit. He throws 97 instead of 99. Had some injuries the previous 2 years. So like the Rays being a team that can't afford to get like an $11 million decision wrong, or they're just confident in their ability to generate closers to where they just don't want to spend that much money on a guy who isn't necessarily bankable for 60 games and 35-40 saves. So it makes some sense for the White Sox to be interested. They need a reliever. We've been talking about it. Helps to have somebody with save history of saving games, just to give Venable a default option to where he's not hanging Grant Taylor out to dry for a four out save for the third time in a row, or Jordan Leisure if it's not a great matchup for him. Like, I get it. But we've seen the White Sox, invest in closers above all else with, Liam Hendricks and then David Robertson. So it would feel like an echo of that to, a lesser degree, smaller stakes. And if they add a Fairbanks and they add a bat and they add maybe an outfielder, maybe another starting pitcher, and Fairbanks is like part of like a 4-player or 5-player offseason, sure. It just, if it's signing players and hoping that they don't last on the team through July, I think that's another thing that kind of gets old, is when you're rooting for players to see what they could potentially bring back as either a post-high prospect, going from Miguel Vargas to Curtis Meade to whoever comes back in that kind of deal, or like a, A-ball lottery ticket to, again, will kind of be in a different timeline from everything else.
I get that there's an order of operations and some guys are more willing to sign, so you go ahead and get those deals done because you can get them done rather than wait for another player to sign that may address a position of need. And if you wait for them, maybe that player that you targeted ends up signing elsewhere because they got an equal deal and they just weren't going to be patient enough to wait around. I get that there isn't a set order of operations for GMs to work, especially when it comes to free agents. But it would remind, it harkens back to a time where it's like, hey, we need, the White Sox need a better right fielder. Here's Kendall Graveman. What? Oh, and we also got Joe Kelly. Why? You need a right fielder.
You need leads to protect.
That's just kind of how it feel to me. But we know that the White Sox need bullpen help. We saw a lot of ideas in the offseason plan project on SoxMachine.com. I came up with a couple of ideas as well. If Fairbanks wants more than like $7 million, I'm a pass. I feel like you need to spend a little bit more of that type of cash on an outfielder to help solidify that position, especially if the White Sox are still entertaining the idea that any team can call up at any moment and make an offer that Chris Getz can't refuse and ends up trading Luis Robert. You would still need to go, and maybe that extra $20 million helps you if you do trade Robert, find a more dependable outfielder or outfielders. But yeah, Fairbanks could be a little too rich for my liking, especially with how little money the Chicago White Sox have to spend this offseason. And again, if the White Sox do make any signings or trades, make sure you go to SoxMachine.com as we'll continue to report the news. That will conclude this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast, recapping the Monday of the 2025 winter meetings. I want to thank Mike Farron for joining the show and chatting with me. We all hope that you enjoy this episode. More audio and video content is also coming to you on Tuesday, as we'll be covering that day of the winter meetings in Orlando. That's a big day, the MLB draft lottery. Jim Margulis will be on hand to cover the MLB draft lottery and see where the Chicago White Sox will be picking. And then on Wednesday is the Rule 5 draft. So some big milestones of the winter meetings coming up for the Chicago White Sox, and you can get all that news on SoxMachine.com. If you just discovered the Sox Machine podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen to the show and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. We're on all the social media platforms at Sox Machine. Follow James Fegan at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and these winter meetings and would like access to our exclusive content, make sure to go to SoxMachine.com/products and sign up for a subscription. Monthly plans start at $5. You also get a discount with annual subscriptions. Again, the Defector, if you listen to our previous episode, is having an annual membership drive, a 2-for-1. You sign up for an annual membership with defector.com, you get a free SoxMachine.com annual membership. So for the price of one, you get two memberships. So take advantage of that deal. Go to defector.com. Or if you don't want a defector.com membership, but you still want a Sox Machine one, you can still go to us and sign
up. Give us all the money.
Exactly.
Screw Defector.
Exactly. not Screw Defector. Don't take that to them. I did not say that.
It's late. We've been working hard today. All bets are off.
It's been a long day, but we all hope that you enjoy our coverage of the winter meetings. And again, if you want access, go to SoxMachine.com/products. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.